On this week's 51%, we speak with psychotherapist Dr. Judith Smith about how parenting doesn't stop once children reach adulthood, and how being the safety net for difficult adult children weighs extra heavy on moms.
Just to remember that this is a universally hard thing, and to not feel shame if things are not going perfectly.
We also hear from the women behind a new children's book highlighting the experience of transracial adoptees. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. There's a common saying or belief that once you become a parent, you never really stop being a parent. And we're living at a time where, for many, that is true in a very literal sense. During the coronavirus pandemic, a survey by the Pew Research Center found more than half of young adults in the U.S. between the ages of 18 and 29 were living with their parents. It's not unusual nowadays for children to graduate high school or college and spend a few years living at home while they work to get on their own feet. That doesn't have to be a bad thing. But what if your adult child is living with you because they are literally incapable of taking care of themselves? What if they suffer from a serious mental illness or a substance use disorder? What does mothering look like when your child is well into adulthood and you are 60, 70, or even 80 years old? Our main guest today has been interviewing moms and studying their difficult relationships with their children over the past few years. Dr. Judith Smith is a psychotherapist based in New York City and professor emerita of Fordham University. Her new book detailing her research is called Difficult: Mothering Challenging Adult Children Through Conflict and Change. In it, she shares the stories of several women whose lives were thrown out of balance by being the default safety net for their adult kids. And she lays out some coping strategies for those struggling to stay afloat in these dynamics.
Parenting an adult child is the longest part in the mother-child relationship. We have thousands of books about the first 3 years of life, but the part of life that's the longest in the mother-child relationship is from 20 till you die. I think so much we talk about mothers and daughters, we talk about what it was like to be mothered. You know, that we have so many things about narcissistic mothers or mothers with mental illness. My focus is on what it's like to be a mother. And in fact, every person who has a serious mental illness, and by serious mental illness, I mean an illness that can evolve into psychosis or hallucinations. And there's like 15 million people in our country who have a serious mental illness. Every single one of them has a mother and or a father. And everybody who has a substance use disorder has a parent. And what happens if you have serious mental illness or a serious substance use disorder, you often can't continue to work. You can't afford to continue living on your own. Your relationships usually fall apart. And who do you turn to? You turn to mom and you come home and you say, can I live here? Can I sleep on the couch? And, you know, some people call them boomerang babies, boomerang kids. But these are kids who are not going to bounce back. They're not boomeranging back into the world. So my work is understanding what happens to the woman herself who at 60 years old, 70 year old, has an adult child who's not able to take care of themselves.
Tell me a little bit more about your decision to label the situation as, you know, like a difficult adult child, and what exactly falls into that category. It sounds like mental illness falls into it, as well as substance use disorder. But are there any other situations that could sort of fall underneath that category? And I do feel like when we talk about it, you know, it is kind of walking a line. And you pointed out in the book that, you know, the goal is not to look at the struggles that a child might be going through and then label them difficult. But that word is also an accurate descriptor for what moms are experiencing too. So there is definitely sort of like this, you know, this line that we have to walk of not wanting to be pejorative toward the adult child, but also not wanting to dismiss or neglect the mother's experience. So I guess tell me a little bit more about your decision to use the word difficult.
Well, it's really difficult mothering. And difficult mothering is when you have an adult child who is not able to take care of themselves. and you become very worried and you want to help out. I mean, how our society defines what we should do as mothers. We have two jobs as mothers. We're supposed to launch our kids. And if we can launch our kids, then they're successful and we're successful. We feel like we did our job. But the other job besides launching your kids is you're supposed to be there when they're in crisis. So I think this is one of the hardest things as a parent is to decide how much do I do? You know, I want to be there. He has no place to live. She has no place to live. Of course, come live with me. But if she's living in your house and your house is suddenly chaotic and she's screaming at you all the time, should you kick her out? So the difficult is the choices that a woman is faced with in later life about how much do I do? How do I face that I can't cure their mental illness, that I can't cure the substance use? I didn't know when I started this project what the issues would be. It could have been she doesn't visit me enough. You know, she's marrying somebody outside of our faith. I didn't know what the issues were that would really pain a mom. My mom might have said she doesn't visit enough. That would have been what upset her about me. But the moms who I spoke to, who chose, you know, I went to senior centers and asked people to tell me about if anybody had an adult kid over 40 who was struggling, I wanted to talk to them. And the issues those who chose to speak with me talked about was serious mental illness and substance use disorder and chronic unemployment. And depression is part of all this and suicidality is part of all this. But I didn't know what a difficult adult child was before I started this. And I coined the name difficult adult child. And I think it's a better name than saying my son is an addict. My daughter is schizophrenic. It said, if you say I have a difficult adult child, you can learn less difficult ways of how to handle it. And we don't have a concept for mothers to be able to tell their friends and family that they're struggling with their difficult adult children.
Of the women that you spoke with, you know, what were some of the common threads that you saw throughout these experiences?
Well, I think one common thread was the terrible feeling of shame and guilt that the women carried, and that they felt so alone because there's, you know, it's very different if your child has cancer. Your neighbors understand, you know, they bring you a casserole. If your child has a psychiatric break, you don't get any casserole. People don't know how to respond. They stop asking you questions. And there's an assumption in our society that mental health problems are caused by our mothers in particular. I mean, we have a lot of jokes about bad mothers, but mothers assume that they can do anything. I mean, we're made to believe that we can create a healthy next generation. And when things are off, when our kids are little or when they're teens, or as adults, we feel terrible sorrow for our kids that they did not fulfill their promise. But we also somehow think, what did I do wrong? Was it because I was a working mother? Was it because I got divorced? Was it because I spoiled her? All kinds of thoughts go through their heads.
When it comes to, I guess, like the more like physical impacts on women as they're having to take care of their children at such an older age, you know, how did you see it throwing women off course or derailing their own lives in order to take care of their kids?
Absolutely. And the taking care of is different than how we think of taking care of an infant. It's having to worry all the time. If you let your child move in with you and they are extremely depressed or having a psychotic episode, your own physical safety is at risk. Many people don't know that the most likely perpetrator of elder abuse within families is the adult child who has serious mental illness or substance use disorder. So parents' physical safety and mother's physical safety is at risk if you're living with your adult child who is very volatile and has problems. But also, if you're always so worried about your kid, whether they're living with you or they're living separately, is you often don't put in the time to go to the doctor yourself. One woman put off having a hysterectomy that she needed for 2 years because she was so worried about getting her son in a safe place. And she could have risked her own life by that. And people feel, one woman had very, very high blood pressure. She'd gone to her doctor, she was 80 years old. And her doctor said, you're going to die. Your blood pressure is too high. You have to eliminate the stress. The stress was her daughter, who was 50 years old with bipolar disease, and her grandson, who had bipolar disease, living in her tiny apartment with her. So she was faced, she said, I'm at the crossroads. What do I do? Do I throw them out? So it was her health or her child's safety. The idea for a mother to evict her child, this woman didn't have the money to put her kids in a separate apartment. I mean, this is where resources matter. If you have a lot of money, you can afford to put your difficult adult kids in a separate apartment. If you don't, you have to live with them. And at some point it becomes unbearable, but the idea of knowing that your child is going to become homeless is one of the most awful choices a parent ever has to make.
I mean, what did she end up doing?
I mean, I didn't know when I left her after the interview what she would do. I didn't think she would do it. And I did some follow-up interviews to find out how people were doing COVID, and they ended up staying for another few years. And eventually her daughter was able to move out. So that was a good ending. And she didn't die. So
that's good. I'm glad you brought up some specific examples, because I was going to ask, you know, when you were speaking with mothers, was there something that particularly surprised you or a story that particularly struck you as like, I was never expecting to find this?
Well, nobody had ever walked me through what it was like to have your own child strangle you, attack you. I mean, I had heard of family violence, but the idea that this person that you were so committed to could attack you, and the terrible shame and how hard it was for people to get help. You know, I am just struck. I now run support groups for mothers who have difficult adult children. And I think what surprises me, and I guess I started this study as a clinical study to understand people's coping mechanisms. But what I also realized that there was a huge policy problem here is we do not have sufficient psychiatric beds. Right now, our current policy is it's very hard to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital. You have to prove that you are at risk for hurting someone. How do you prove that you're at serious risk for hurting yourself or hurting someone else? But if you do get in, you're in for 2 days and then you're out. We have very, very few long-term psychiatric beds in our country. They were closed in the 1960s. And we were promised community mental health services. We didn't get them. And we do not have sufficient substance use treatment centers that are affordable. So mothers are left with this really unspoken assumption that they're going to take over, because as a society, we are not providing for vulnerable adults. And if you know housing, you know, as for a person who's working full time, it's hard to find housing in most cities. Think about if you are unemployed, living on disability, it's impossible to find a place to live. So parents are really the safety net for their kids when they're 60 years old, 70 years old, 80 years old. And that's a terrible place to be. And then as people get older, most women are worried about what happens when I'm gone. Here I am being the safety net. And what's going to happen to her when I'm gone? And the other main thread that I found across all the women is the enormous sense of shame that they carry. I mean, I get letters from women all the time saying, thank you for writing this book. It's the first time I see my experience on the page. And then when people come to the group, I run them virtually. The idea of sitting in a room with seven other women who also have adult kids who have not thrived, have not gone to Harvard, have, you know, had their dreams have been cut off, there's an enormous sense of relief of, I am not alone. I did not cause this. I am not crazy. And once you can stop blaming yourself, you can begin to find ways to cope with the situation.
In the book, you lay out some coping strategies or sort of like a method for getting through these kinds of dynamics. Is there any other advice that you'd like to give women on that front?
The third part of the book is about change. And you can't change your adult child, unfortunately. Every mother has tried 100 times, and you might be lucky to find your moment when you help them to get hooked up with a good treatment center, but what you can change is yourself and how you handle this and begin to learn to lower your anxiety. And what I talk about in the book is three things that you need to work on. The first is getting social support. Study after study shows that being in a group with other people who are experiencing the same thing is the most effective way to address stress. The second thing is self-care. And I don't mean self-care like take bubble baths or, you know, but certain self-care like go to the doctor every year. If you exercise, they found that many of these moms are depressed because you're upset that your kid's future has been changed. We know that exercise is good for depression, but studies have shown that going for a walk with your friend is going to alleviate your depression more than just going for a walk. So self-care, you know, finding ways to connect with other people, and it may not be family. Family ties often get strained during this. So finding new groups of people who will understand. And the third part is staying safe. So there's very small things. If you are living in a house with an abusive adult child, you put a lock on your door. You get to know your local police officer if you have to call the police. And there are certain things called orders of protection that don't necessarily exclude the person from living in your house, but it's a piece of paper that you can say, if you threaten me again, if you come after me, I will call the police. And that can be help sort of set some real boundaries. But the main thing is to realize you are not alone. And I think in terms of the overall picture, it's mothering adult children for all moms is hard. Adult kids and parents have different agendas. The adult child is trying to become independent and the mom is trying to help secure her legacy. And just to remember that this is a universally hard thing and to not feel shame if things are not going perfectly.
Dr. Judith Smith is a psychotherapist based in New York City and professor emerita of Fordham University. Her book is Difficult, Mothering Challenging Adult Children Through Conflict and Change. It's out now through Roman and Littlefield Publishers. You can learn more at difficultmothering.com. Judy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here in New York, the legislative session ends June 6th. In the final days, New York Governor Kathy Hochul is not giving up a push to regulate social media companies and how they use algorithms that negatively affect what children see in their feeds. Karen DeWitt with the New York Public News Network has more.
Hochul says passing laws to ban tech companies from sharing kids' personal data and using harmful algorithms to steer their social media feeds are her top priorities for the final 2 weeks of the legislative session.
There's one area where I know we can make a real difference, and this is the effects of the addictive, and the addictive word is the word I'm focusing on, addictive algorithms that are intended to bombard our young people when they scroll social media and to draw them in deeper and make it harder for them to put down their device or to interact at a personal level with others.
There's been stiff resistance from tech companies, including Meta and Google, and there are currently not enough votes in the legislature to pass the bills. Hochul says talks with the tech companies are continuing.
My experience tells me that the initial reaction to legislation that tells an industry what our values are, what we think they should be doing, is always met with resistance. It's very natural. But when they see that we are committed to doing something, we will not be scared off because of initial objections. We're sticking with this fight. We're not giving up. So now it's time to come to the table and work with us.
Hochul says the legislation would also require better age verification requirements. She says those steps would go beyond simply filling in a birth date. Hochul says it's urgent that lawmakers act before the session ends in early June. She says she does not want a whole generation of young New Yorkers struggling with mental health challenges. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
Our next guests are the authors behind a new children's book highlighting the experience of transracial adoptees. Eyes That Weave the World's Wonders is the second follow-up to Joanna Ho's New York Times best-selling picture book, Eyes That Kiss in the Corners, about a girl learning to love and celebrate her Asian eyes. This time, Ho teamed up with author and anti-racist educator Liz Kleinrock to tell the story of a young girl who not only learns to appreciate her Asian eyes, but finds familial connection through them, even though she is no longer with her birth family and looks very different from the parents who adopted her. For Kleinrock, it's a personal story. Because, well, it's her story. Kleinrock was born in South Korea, but grew up with her adopted family in Washington, D.C. She says she hopes the book will help other kids navigate the dual senses of love and loss that come with transracial adoption.
I was so incredibly excited when Joanna approached me. Like, we had already started to develop this friendship through social media that transformed into an in real life friendship, which has been just such a gift considering that social media can also be such a dumpster fire out there.
And
was just really grateful that she wanted to amplify my voice and my story through this book. It is one adoption story out of the many that are out there. I would never, ever want people to think that I am trying to speak on behalf of all adoptees or that this one book is representative of all adoptee experiences, because that could actually not be farther from the truth.
Well, one, I want to say that the book is beautiful, and I really liked how you discuss a person's eyes in a way that goes beyond just what they look like. You know, you use them to describe the things that your family members are passionate about and how they use them to interact with the world and their loved ones, and it's just beautifully and delicately done. You know, Liz, when it comes to the transracial adoptee experience, what were some of the main messages you were hoping to get across here?
I think one of the most important messages for me is that adoption is really complicated, and that we can't make assumptions about how adoptees must feel or what their experiences must be like. Something that I'm very passionate about in my work is really emphasizing the ability to embrace complexity and nuance, and to be able to hold space for multiple true things at the same time, even when it seems like those truths might even come into conflict with one another. So, for example, in this book, that as an adoptee, I feel the loss and grief and sadness about not knowing my biological family, or the loss of the opportunity to grow up in my ancestral homeland with that culture. And there's a lot of trauma that comes alongside that too. And at the same time, I very much love my adoptive family. Like, we're very, very close, and I do like the life that I have now too. So for some people, that might be really challenging to be able to hold space for both of those realities at the same time. But for me, that is just my everyday existence.
So how do you go about translating that into a picture book? Were there any scenes that especially struck you when you saw the finished product?
I think there's one illustration in particular that some adoptees truly might find triggering, like really causing some traumatic past experiences or memories to surface. Even the first time I saw this illustration, I sobbed. It just took me by so much surprise to be able to actually see, like, actually multiple illustrations of my birth mother represented. Because so often when it comes to adoptee literature, especially children's books, birth parents, biological parents, first families, adoptees use a lot of different language to describe these people, but there's almost no recognition and certainly not visual representation. And we have both of that. And I'm really, really proud of it.
Picture books, I think, are really powerful because of exactly what you said, that there is really an economy of words. You have to write and craft a story that has an emotional arc and a beginning and a middle and an end. And you have 400 to maybe 600 words to do it if you want the book to actually be read aloud to children. And within that, there are so many layers of complexity and nuance, as Liz mentioned. And so every word and every scene is packed with meaning and layers. And the illustrations themselves by Zung Ho, who is an illustrator from Vietnam, who lives in Vietnam, add on to those layers. So between the text and the illustrations, I think there is so much meaning that is conveyed in a format that, you know, we say is for children, but I think is actually really for everyone.
Liz, you mentioned holding space for multiple emotions. If you don't mind my asking, how did you come to terms with missing your birth mother and loving your adopted family? Is there anything we can do, you know, besides this book to help kids hold that space for those emotions?
I have to be honest, like, I'm an adult. I'm in my 30s. I don't know if it's something I'll ever get over or there'll ever be a moment where it's like, okay, I'm healed now. I think it's just this ongoing process and you take every day as it comes. Some days I feel great. I feel really secure in who I am. And other days I'm a crying mess. I've had the opportunity to go to Korea quite a few times. And every time I'm there, all these new emotions come up, and transitioning back to being in the United States takes a really big emotional toll all over again. But when I think about the ways that we can support young adoptees, the most simple thing that can have so much impact is simply to listen, to come from a place of curiosity rather than a place of assumption, especially if adoptees are talking about sad feelings or grief. Because so often growing up, I heard a lot of, you should be so lucky, you should be so grateful, like really, like I think well-intentioned, but very gaslighting, dismissive things were said whenever I would try to talk about it. And so making sure that non-adoptees are not projecting their own assumptions or putting words in adoptees' mouths. I think for adoptive parents, just being really mindful that the process of understanding identity is a lifelong journey. I understand that some families might swing fully in one direction by being like, we're going to educate and immerse our child into all of like their ancestral or birth family culture. And that might not be actually what that child wants or needs at that moment, but it's nice for them to know the option is there.
Well, Joanna, this is your third book in the Eyes series. For those who don't know, how does this weave into some of the overall lessons that you're hoping to bring to kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first book in this series, and also was my debut book, is called Eyes That Kiss in the Corners. It tells the story of a young Taiwanese American girl who comes to understand the beauty and the power that is contained in the eyes, in her eyes, and how it connects her to her family and her history. And that's explored through the relationship she has with the women in her family in a system where Asian eyes are often ridiculed or shown to be less beautiful or even demonized. And so it really is, you know, what it says in the book is that she realizes she's a revolution. She has power to create change and within her own self and family and in the community. And Eyes That Speak to the Stars is the second book. It follows a young boy and his male family members and is a little bit more explicit about, you know, at least one microaggression that he faces from friends from his eyes. And he goes on a very similar journey of recognizing his own power in the world. And I think that both, all three of these books really tie together because they really are about empowering all people to find the power they have. Eyes That Weave the World's Wonders ultimately is about the main character understanding that despite the questions that might ever be answered in her own life and with the love of her family, she actually is able, she can tell her own stories, and there are stories only she can tell. And she is able to craft a future for herself because of the past that she has, even though there might be gaps in her own knowledge and in her own family.
Joanna Ho and Liz Kleinrock are the authors behind the children's book, Eyes That Weave the World's Wonders. It's out now through HarperCollins. Kleinrock also works as an anti-racist educator and consultant for schools and companies across the U.S. You can learn more about her work at teachandtransform.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at WAMC.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. he was a hollow light. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my